Hello and welcome to the 97th weekly Guardian Film Show, a battle royale of celluloid slaughter in which we pit cinema release against cinema release and see which will rise the people's champion. In the arena this week, murder, rebellion, boys. Jennifer Lawrence serves up a second helping of teenage warfare with The Hunger Games catching fire. Robert De Niro shows off some old tricks in Luc Besson's grizzled gangster comedy, The Family. And Andrew Bajowski has brains take brawn with geek chic indie comedy, Computer Chess. But first up, it's The Young Pretender. Blue is the warmest colour. This year's Palme d'Or winner follows a French teenager through her relationship with an older college student played by Léa Seydoux. Sexually explicit, frank and unwavering, here's the bits of the film we're allowed to show you. These are the early days of Adele and Emma, the start of a relationship that will harbour love, betrayal, lots of good food, and loads of great sex. Abdellatif Kechiche's three-hour drama has gained infamy for sex scenes many have called gratuitous. Peer past the panting lovebirds to its winningly romantic heart. Joining me now for scenes of hardcore extended criticism are The Guardian's Peter Bradshaw and our film editor, Catherine Shord. Peter, everybody, including me just now, has talked up the sexually explicit nature of the film. Yes. Is it too much hoo-ha over nothing?
I'm not sure that it is. There's been a lot of debate about that particular scene, most particularly led by, the debate is led by Julie Marot, who wrote the original graphic novel, and she says that it is basically a straight person's fantasy of what gay sex looks like. And I'm not sure what to think about that. I think there's a lot of debate, quite surreal, that I've been reading, that whether or not the absence or presence of pubic hair means that the sex being shown is authentic. I think that's very quaint and very naive, really. I mean, I think it's fictional. It's fictional. My take on this is that it's no more authentic or inauthentic than any other scene about anything else in the movie. It's fictional. What it is passionate and full on. And I think it's rather magnificent, actually. What's emerged for me, watching it again, is not merely that it's very erotic, but that it's very romantic and quite tragic, actually, at the end. And I really thought it was a brilliant film.
And presumably all the sex and all the arguments wouldn't really make sense if it wasn't a convincing love story in its own right.
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of sex and it's quite one note. It's quite, you know, the point it's making is this is very good sex.
Yeah.
And it is actually quite different from the sex in the graphic novel. I mean, just in terms of the positioning. And you know, if you wanted to add smoke to the straight men's fantasy of lesbians.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, for me, you know, those sex scenes, they weren't boring exactly, but they teetered on the edge of it.
Yeah.
Because you get the message pretty quickly. You know, they're having great sex, and that's great. And they're, you know, it's a very sexually healthy relationship. For me, there wasn't a lot more to the relationship, I have to say. You know, I couldn't really get in their heads. And, you know, we get that Adele's character is voracious and you know, eats scabs. And there's a lot of sort of metaphors involving food and consumption. And it left me a little bit cold after all that hoo-ha.
Peter, do you agree with that? Do you think it's
no? I have to say, I don't get the idea that it's boring. I'm slightly kind of gobsmacked by people who think I get more the idea that it's inauthentic. I understand where that's coming from. The idea that it's boring, I don't know. When we see lots of boring things in the movies, which we never comment on how boring they are, and yet when there's explicit sex, it seems we always say we rush to say, oh, how boring.
It genuinely was quite boring.
Oh well, fair enough. Okay. Okay. Wow. I don't know what it says about me. I didn't think it was boring. I think the idea of the emotional or societal sub-dom relationship is interesting. She's the one who's worldly. She's the one who's posher and more sophisticated. It's the high schooler Adele who is always being led by the hand. And yet, what I think is interesting is that Keshis implies that she's the one who achieves a kind of maturity, sketched out in her, first of all, being a student and then a teacher. She achieves a kind of emotional maturity, which Emma, played by Seydoux, she does not achieve.
It seems to be a lot about Adele as well that is, she's just almost greedy in the way she experiences life. She just seems to want to take everything, whether it be sexually or food or experience. And to me, she felt like an older, more mature character for that, that she was willing to try everything, really, to work out who she was.
Yeah, I guess, you know, but it's, I get, you know.
Try and give it depth.
Yeah.
Come on,
but,
with me.
But for a film that's 3 hours long.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the sex scenes for me were symptomatic of a larger thing that you, it's not like you came out of the film and thought, God, they couldn't have lost anything. Mm. Like, you really could have, you could have chopped a good hour out of it without, I think, that much. You know, for me, it felt, it made it feel kind of soapy, like a mini series.
Yeah.
And her kind of so-called life coming of age sort of, you know, dynamic. You know, they're great. They're great. They're great actresses. They're very beautiful. And it's very French. And but, oh, my God.
Now, Peter, this film's had quite a torrid affair since its debut at Cannes, as is. Yeah. I mean, the stars have come out saying that they felt exploited by some of the scenes they're asked to shoot, that they had day-long shoots where they had to be really slapping each other in the face, and that the sex scenes were grotesque and miserable. Yeah. I mean, can you feel that in the film? I don't think you
can.
No,
I can't. I think what's fascinating about it is there's always, I think in every film, a secret history of resentment between actors and director. And everybody in this business puts on smiles for the cameras and agrees to forget about it, basically. This is one of those very rare occasions where people have not agreed to forget about it. And in fact, the huge success of the film has turned the gas up underneath these simmering resentments between Julie Marot and the director and the two actors. Clearly, I think, Steven Spielberg, in asking the two actors to come up on stage and share the Palme d'Or, that lit the touch paper between the three of them, frankly. I think it's interesting. I think we're naive in thinking that this, it only has happened on this film. I think it happens in 99% of the films we see. We just don't get to hear about it.
It strikes me as rather disingenuous because, I mean, the power of the film for me came absolutely from those sort of final reel scenes in which they're confronting each other and breaking down. And, you know, they were genuinely affecting. And although I wasn't actually moved by a lot of the film, you know, you tear up in those scenes because they are powerful. And that kind of thing only comes from the actors themselves having been under great stress and pressure. And it's produced from the both of them possibly career best performances. And, yeah, you're an actress. You know, it's not forcing you to get your kiss off. And actually, you know, these sex scenes, they're explicit. They're not gynecological. You know, you don't, you know.
L'organiser, pasteur.
Oh, Emma! Ça va? Puis non, on peut pas parler 5 minutes avec des gens, là!
Blue is the warmest colour, and now let's spend time with another lady killer. The Hunger Games Catching Fire sees Jennifer Lawrence return as teenage warrior Katniss Everdeen, thrown into a televised fight to the death. The Guardian's Paul McInnes went down to meet J-Law as she took a break from all that needless slaughter.
The victors of the 74th Hunger Games, Katniss Everdeen and Peter Mallock.
Not who they think she is. She just wants to save her skin. Simple as that. She has become a beacon of hope for them. So she has to be eliminated.
In this film, there is out in the districts, there's a sign of rebellion, uprising against a violent oppression. Do you think that could ever happen in America?
I do. I mean, you know, it did. I think that, you know, we live in a world where history repeats itself, and I don't think anytime soon. I think that rebellions can happen when there's enough people with the same voice. But I also think that something that we're very aware of in this movie and these books and a part of this world was the consequences of this kind of thing, and the consequences of idealism and killing people over it, and then ending up with just more death and not really a great ending. Just because it's a rebellion doesn't mean you're going to get what you want.
Katniss Everdeen is a symbol. We don't have to destroy her, just her image. Show them that she is one of us now. Let them rally behind that. They're gonna hate her so much, they might just kill her for you.
Hamish, please, please just help me get through this trip.
This trip doesn't end when you get back home.
So what do we do?
From now on, your job is to be a distraction so people forget what the real problems are.
She's very reluctant because she really just wants to get out with as little death as possible. She's very aware of the consequences of war. But she's very gung-ho because she's living in a, you know, in a government where it's just not fair. And I think when her own family and when the people close to her start to get affected by it, it becomes easier for her to be able to stand up for it.
Peter, we got Katniss Everdeen back as a reluctant revolutionary this time.
I'm not sure that it's really that much different from the first film, really. I think it's a typical franchise kind of volume two, where basically it's a retread, it's the same thing, but without the novelty and without, frankly, the sense of something being at stake, because you know it's going to come back and come back and come back. Having said that, I did quite enjoy it. I really enjoyed the first Hunger Games. I didn't expect to. Because I thought that this sort of silliness factor would creep in, but it didn't, and I still quite like this. I think Jennifer Lawrence herself is almost before our very eyes morphing into this much more sleek and starry kind of star creation. If you think of what she used to be like in early kind of indie movies.
Do you think that takes away from this character?
No, it's partly to do with the film. I mean, I get that, but it's very interesting how she herself has absorbed that sort of Oscar glamour, and she has become very different from what she was in Winter's Bone, for example. Yeah. I mean, she's becoming almost like Liz Taylor in Cleopatra in this film. What it's losing is the satirical potential of the first one. The first one could claim satirical status, that it's satirizing reality TV, it's satirizing celebrity culture, and it's satirizing meanness and bullying and fear and anxiety and all those things which we've sort of absorbed into our reality TV culture. Yeah. Now, We are asked to take it much more seriously, and the satirical aspect of it is, perhaps it was never all that prominent in the first place, but now it is bleeding into.
I wondered if maybe the satire of it was perhaps a little accidental, in that you have Jennifer Lawrence now becoming a star and becoming a genuine celebrity in her own right. And so much of the film is about Katniss's victory tour and her being this prize that the Capitol is showing off to the districts as a celebrity in herself. You can pull parallels between the two there, right?
Yeah, you can. I mean, I did and do quite enjoy Donald Sutherland as the maligned president, and Philip Seymour Hoffman looking like a kind of more and more like a kind of maligned,
like the Simon Cowell.
Yeah, sort of almost like a panda. He just looks so kind of like a sort of animal. He's just so kind of sinister, and I did quite enjoy his performance. But the sort of Team Jacob, Team Edward thing going on with the two boys, I think is slightly taking the mickey out of us, to be honest with you.
Catherine, what is it about Jennifer Lawrence that means that she can carry a franchise like this? What's she got?
Well, she's got charm. I mean, everyone loves her, don't they? I haven't seen this one, but it's interesting to compare it with Twilight and think about how girls in particular didn't really go for Kristen Stewart, you know, and her sort of profile at this stage in the franchise. It's very interesting how it will change it. I'm interested that she's become so much more glossy, but she is so unbelievably charming. It's really an unusual quality, you know, and it sort of puts these other, you know, people of her level in some sort of context, I think.
So what do we do? I think these games are going to be different.
The 75th Hunger Games!
Ready to work?
There she is, Katniss Everdeen, the girl on fire!
That's the girl on fire. Now time for the veteran off the boil. Robert De Niro stars in Luc Besson's The Family, in which Bobby and his brood escape the mob by moving to small town France.
There was a time when I had it all.
people would ask me, what was it like being untouchable? The question they really should have asked was, what happens when it's all over?
Robert De Niro plays Giovanni Manzini, a mafia turncoat relocated to Normandy. The plan is to hide out and lay low, if only his family hadn't brought the old country's ways with them. They're arsonists, racketeers, and thugs to a man. Witness protection can keep them safe from everything but themselves.
Anything to report?
Kids, cool.
Oops. Yeah, you know, they always adjust better than we do.
Catherine, just when we'd seen Silver Linings Playbook and thought Robert De Niro was making a comeback, and then...
You're forgetting The Big Wedding.
The Big
Wedding. So we knew he wasn't, I'm afraid.
Temperature was already dropping.
Right now. And this, I mean, Big Wedding was shocking. This is really bad.
Is it worse?
I think it's... No, it's not quite worse. The Big Wedding was biscuit-takingly bad. Mm. This is pretty dreadful. I mean, it's tonally, it's very peculiar.
All over the place.
It has no idea. And, you know, it's meant to be funny that they're sort of so violent, but it's not, because there's the collateral damage. I mean, he kills so many people in a sort of comedy way. And Michelle Pfeiffer burns down supermarkets and the kids, you know, really smash people's faces in. And there's rape. You know, it's not that funny. And it's just bananas, isn't it?
It's tonally stranded between like A Year in Provence and Goodfellas, right?
Yeah,
it's
this but weird... not in a good way. That could
yeah,
be good.
Other world.
And it's just, it doesn't explain things. So at one point, Michelle Pfeiffer's in a supermarket and they say, oh, that'll be 87 francs. And you think, bloody hell, how long has it been on the shelf? You know? But I mean, so if it was set like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it needed to say that. It never says that. It just kind of presents this bizarre old... It's just, you know, the framing's off, the tone's off, the script is dreadful, the performances are, I guess they're okay.
Yeah.
But...
This is a criticism we can throw at Luc Besson for a lot of things, though. I mean, the film he did fairly recently before this was The Extraordinary Adventures of Adèle Blanc-Sec, which was a cartoonish young adult book that is adapted into a film. But again, there was very strange, violent scenes in that which seemed completely out of whack with... anything going on in the rest of the story.
I mean, it is, you know, I think it is that problem that you're meant to laugh. Or are you meant to laugh?
I'm not sure.
Near the end, there's these scenes where all these sort of French neighbours come out in their pyjamas and get blown to bits by horrible mob men. And I don't know if it's meant to be funny. I think it's probably not quite meant to be funny, but it's not meant to be tragic. It just feels so wildly misjudged from beginning to end, this film. I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah. I think we'd be remiss about mentioning that there is a parody on Goodfellas or a meta mention of Goodfellas in which Robert De Niro sits down to watch Goodfellas. And I didn't understand why he wouldn't recognise himself.
No, that is, but it's just upsetting. You just think, what are you doing? What the hell are you doing? Yeah. And also, you know, you've got Tommy Lee Jones is in this. And Tommy Lee Jones, Robert De Niro, Michelle Pfeiffer. And you just think, you can't need the money that much. What the hell are you doing?
You all right?
Nothing much. Just the prospect of packing up again and moving when they find out you killed the plumber.
I didn't kill him. I took him to the hospital.
Why'd you beat him to a pulp? He's the only plumber within a radius of 20 miles.
But he disrespected us and he made you wait on him, honey.
Jeez, honey, I survived.
And you know, the guy was trying to rip me off, so put yourself in my shoes.
Well, I definitely wouldn't have beat him up.
That's Luc Besson's The Family, shooting pensioners in their PJs in the pursuit of laughs. And now time for our final fighter. It's a black and white comedy about the development of artificial intelligence in the early days of the personal computer revolution. This is Computer Chess.
Well, this should have been an easy win for Stasia. Like, any human being can see that there's a force, queen takes queen, and it's a very easy victory for white. But instead, queen checks, queen checks, check, 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 back and forth over and over again. Lost in a loop. Very, very embarrassing, wouldn't you say?
Don't laugh, the Terminator will come of this lot. Andrew Bajalski's bizarre mockumentary throws a group of geeks into an automated chess tournament, then plots the rise of the machines one move at a time. They don't know it yet, but this is mankind's endgame.
I think we're searching the tree deeply enough now that we're catching pretty much all of the tactical issues.
But Stasia's greatest weakness, which I think is the same weakness we all our programs share, is that it really has a very poor understanding of the positional issues.
Peter, this is very odd, very strange, but kind of great, right?
I thought it was absolutely great. It grew on me very slowly, and by the end, I basically achieved geekgasm, or retrogasm. I thought it was really strange, genuinely unusual, genuinely weird and new. It is very, very strange. First of all, it really does look like a black and white analog amateur video taken at the time. I mean, it really does. And Bujalski starts with this uncompromisingly boring introductory section. It's almost zen. You think, what the hell am I watching here? But that's part of the genius, is he starts bleeding in the weirdness from there. I thought this was the first sort of mumblecore or post-mumblecore film that I genuinely liked. He had something genuinely new and weird and unusual. It reminded me a bit of Harmony Korine's film Trash Humpers. I don't know if you saw that. It had the same fetish for uncool analog video. Had that kind of weird sheen, that kind of glowing effect, the white light glowing effect, which people who are into digital, of course, will bend over backwards to get rid of that. That's the sort of horrible glowing analog effect that is just so awful, and you're trying to get rid of that. But of course, part of the genius of the film, that Bujalski embraces it. So this is what it looks like. It has this kind of strange, uncinematic look. I don't know, I can't recommend it enough. It's very strange, though. You've got to make a real investment in it.
Yeah, it really does. It tries your patience, this. I mean, there's something about the setup that feels unmistakably Wes Anderson-esque to it as well. Like, you know, a kooky computer chess club, but then you have these elements of almost Shane Carruth or maybe Garth Marenghi's
Shane
Dark Place.
Yeah, very Shane Carruth, I thought.
Did you like it for that reason, Kevin?
I think it really is a gender divide film, actually. I mean, I did like it, I admired it, and I liked bits of it. I didn't go as crazy for it. I didn't geekasm or whatever, because I think that fetishization of crud is quite niche as an aesthetic to go wild for, and it did try my patience in just a sort of genuine way.
Yeah.
Easy to admire, hard to love, and I think the Carruth sort of comparison is really the key one for me. Same sort of taste problem with it somehow.
Yeah.
It also reminded me a little bit of the 70s indie style of, as it were, Bob Raffleson or Jerry Schatzberg, with the long, very indulgent late night conversations in hotel rooms, which go on for a very long period of time. It's very 70s, I thought.
Yeah.
If Wes Anderson was doing it, he would point up from the word go that it's supposed to be weird and geeky and lovable,
yeah,
and he would make it more romantic and sexier.
Whereas
and
here,
would,
that's almost like a loading screen for the strange stuff that's about
that's
to happen.
That's nothing,
right?
Like that happened at all. Wes Anderson would do weird direct sight lines into camera. He would do all those things that make you realise, yes, this is what's happening now. Whereas this behaves in an extraordinary way. It behaves like an amateur documentary in the most extraordinary way. And I absolutely get what Catherine's saying. Yes, it's easy to admire, not easy to like.
Can you try do your own move on your own?
Seems to be a little glitch here.
War is death. Hell is pain. Chess is victory.
That's Computer Chess, and that's us, Checked and Mated, Bloodied and Battered. Round 98 of the Guardian Film Show starts next week. Thanks to Peter and Catherine for joining me. Thanks to you for watching, and we'll see you then.